accession number 18729, Reel 4.
This is Bothwell, Reel 4.
I said to him, can I have a few minutes to pop down to the baker's? In the rush lunchtime, I forgot to get the bread for Mother. She's gone out for the day with my younger sisters, and she won't be back in time to pick up any bread. So he said, no, that's all right. We're not very busy. So I went to the baker's shop two doors down the road, and they'd sold out. So I had to go down towards the town. And on the corner of the High Street, Wolverhampton Street, and Union Street, the crossways, there was a baker's just before the last building, which was a bank. And I went in there, and there was a young girl behind the counter. And I said, oh, I didn't know that there was a baker's shop here. I said, it's ages since I came down this part of the town. So she said, oh, we've only been here for about a week. So I said, have you got any bread left? So she said, we've got one very large loaf, or we've got two small brown loaves. So I said, well, I'd better take the large white loaf. I said, because Mum doesn't like the brown bread, wartime stuff. I said, it tastes like sawdust. So she laughed and she agreed with me. So as I was about to pay her for the bread, the door opened and I looked round and two coloured Americans walked in, and there was a third one standing in the doorway, and the other person behind the counter, another woman, he said, oh, have you got any donuts? So she said yes. So I said, do you have chocolate donuts? So she said, no, we don't do those, just the ordinary donuts. So he said, well, I'll have some of those. So I finished paying the girl for my bread, and I turned round to walk out, and the lad who was buying the donuts was the one that had been beaten up that lunchtime. So I said, what are you doing back in the town? So he said, oh, we needed a break, he said, and I wanted to do a bit more shopping. And just then the door burst open, and two American military police sergeants came in, and they were huge men, all over 6 foot, broad, and they'd all got their truncheons drawn, and they were, you know, about to wreak havoc. They grabbed hold of these two, wouldn't even let the lad have his donuts, dragged them out of the shop. The one that had been standing outside, he'd seen the military police wagon coming down the High Street, and he'd dashed across the road to a shoe shop on the opposite corner. They had a little arcade by the entrance, and he ran into this arcade, and the other two were taken round the corner into Union Street, which was a small street, out of my sight. So the girl behind the counter, she said, I'm going to follow them round. I'm going to see what's going on. So I said, well, I said, why do you go round there? I said, I'm going to run across the road to see if the lad in the arcade is okay. Hoping that he'd run out of the arcade the other side and got down Wolverhampton Street. And he was absolutely petrified, this lad. So I walked across, and I went down the side entrance of Wolverhampton Street, and this lad was lying on the floor across the doorway to the shop with his head resting against the glass of one side and his feet the side of the other window. And as I walked into the arcade, I saw the back of the window display on the right-hand side. I saw it being closed. So I went up to this young American, this black American lying on the floor, and I tried to see whether he was alive or dead, and I wasn't getting any response. So I knocked on the I tried to open the shop door, and it was locked. So I knocked on the door, and I knocked and knocked until somebody came to the door. And she opened it up a little bit, and she said, "We're closed." I said, "Well, you're not supposed to close till 5:30. She said, "We're closed." I said, "Well, would you mind telling me why you're closed?" So she said, I said, "Do you know anything about this this American soldier that's lying on the floor here?" She said, "Well," she said, "I noticed him come into the arcade," she said, "while I was putting the final touches to the side window." She said, and she said he was mouthing something at me through the glass. She said, but I couldn't understand what he was saying. And she said, I thought he was asking me for a date. She said, and I'd never seen a black man before. She said, and I was a little bit scared. So she said, I closed up the window. She said, I went and told the rest of the girls about him, and they told me to go and lock the door. So I said, well, why would they want to do that? So she said, well, she said, you hear such stories, she said, about black men. I said, oh, don't be so silly. I said, they're like you and I. They're human beings. So I said, do you know what's happened to him? She said, no. I said, well, shall I tell you something? I said, you said he was knocking on the glass and attracting your attention. Yes. I said, well, he was asking you for help. So she said, you're joking, aren't you? And I said, no. No, I'm not. I said, he was asking for help. He wanted to be allowed to come into the shop. So she said, I said, you do know that he's lying across your doorway and he's possibly dead. She said, oh my goodness. And she went in and she locked the door again. So I stood there, and while I was there, military policeman came into the arcade, and I said, he bent down and he looked at him, examined him, and I said, is he alive? So he said, don't think so, miss. I said, well, what happened? Do you know what happened to him? Now, I knew that this policeman had followed him into the arcade, because I'd seen it as I crossed the road. So he said, no, I don't know what happened to him, miss. I said, are you sure? So he said, oh, you don't believe me. I said, no, I don't. I said, because I saw you follow him over the road. So just then the military police van pulled up, and I said, is he alive or not? I said, because it looks as though he's had his head bashed in. So he said, oh no, miss, he said that isn't, he said he's dead. He said, that isn't what killed him. He said, he was knifed in the heart. I said, well, how did that happen? So he said, oh, he said, he was resisting arrest, he said, and rather than be taken, he killed himself. And he looked at me, he said, you don't believe me, do you? I said, no, I don't. I said, I don't believe you. So he said, well, there's nothing I can do about that, miss. So he picked the lad up and he threw his body into the van. I ran across the road into Union Street to join up with this girl, and she'd been joined by a friend of hers who worked in the shop brand in Union Street. And one of the coloured men was lying in the road with his legs at an awkward angle, and he was screaming his head off. And this policeman was standing over him with his truncheon drawn. and the other man was crouched in a shop doorway, and he'd been banging on the door of the shop, and it was a radio repair shop, and the owner was inside the shop, and a black man had been banging on the door asking to be let in, because he was in fear of his life. He was shouting to the man, "They're going to kill me, they're going to kill me." And the owner went and dropped the latch on the door, locked it, and just stood there watching what was going on. So as I walked into the street, so the wagon pulled up, backed up to this doorway, and they picked up the man lying in the middle of the street, and they didn't put him into the back of the van, they threw him in, and he screamed as he landed on the floor of the van. And then they came up to the shop doorway, and when they pulled up, two or four armed soldiers with guns got out, and they were pointing the guns at the coloured men. And one of them said, "Oh, what happened here, Sergeant?" He said, "Oh," he said, "resisting arrest, causing a riot." And by this time, the driver got out of the front of the vehicle, and he was just an ordinary private, the driver of the van. And I looked at him and I said, "They weren't rioting." I said, those three men were absolutely terrified. I said, "They tried to get away from the policeman." So he said, "I don't know, miss." I said, "Well, I'm telling you what we saw." I said, "And what's happened to the man lying in the road?" He said, "Both his legs have been broken." And they'd picked him up and thrown him into the vehicle. And one of the policemen went up to this shop doorway and he said, "Oh, and what have we got here?" He said, "It does look a bit of a mess." "Oh dear." And I looked across, and this lad, he was crouched down in the corner of the shop doorway. And he got his arm over his head, trying to protect his head like this. And there was blood all down the window, all down the woodwork of the doorway. And he'd slouched right down in a crouched position. And I said to the driver, I said, "Do you know if he's still alive?" And he just shook his head. And he said, "I think you better move back." He said, "They better not see me talking to you." He said, "Otherwise," he said, "they'll arrest me for talking to you." So I said, "Well," I said, "if you get a chance to tell anybody," I said, "those three black men," I said, "were not rioting." I said, "They were running for their lives. They tried to run for their lives when they saw the military policeman coming down the road. And the chap that was killed in the doorway was the young man that had been beaten up at lunchtime. So he had a plaster on his forehead where they'd hit him the first time."
Were the American MPs white or black?
White. Oh, white. They were from the Deep South. And they were, you've seen some of the American films where the countrymen are very macho, not very intelligent, and they behave like gods. Well, these were similar sort of characters. They wore the officers of the law. They represented the law for the American army. And the Americans admitted many years later, because of the brutality that had been meted out to the coloured soldiers when they first came to Britain by the military police, the American authorities, I believe, admitted that they'd recruited these tough men to keep control of the niggers. And when the black Americans first came to Britain, well, not only when they came to Britain, but when they got over in France, they were not allowed to carry guns. They were employed for maintaining the roads, for building bridges, repairing vehicles under strict supervision of the white military police, because they were handling metal tools, and these tools could have been used to attack the white soldiers or the military police. So they were, whatever work they did, if they were using tools of any sort, they were heavily supervised, like they were working on the plantations.
Did you ever see any other evidence of racial tensions amongst the Americans?
No, after that, we didn't see any more in Dudley, because it was the build up to D-Day. They were sending everybody down to Salisbury Plain, and one of my aunties was a manageress in the Nuffield Gosport at the beginning of the war, and she was sent out to Salisbury Plain, and she catered for the officers under the tents. But back to 1939. Blackout started on the 1st of September 1939, and that night, when we got home from school, my mother wanted us to go down to the chemist on the Tyburn Road to get a jar of Vick, because my little sister, she's two, she was very poorly with bronchitis, and Mum had run out of medication, and Dad wasn't back from work, so it was starting to get dark. So she said, "The blackout starts tonight, so you better take the torch." So we took the torch, which the top of the glass of the torch was blacked out, and it had a little mask over the top so that any light didn't shine upwards. And we had to get out onto the Kingsbury Road, cross over one road, go round the corner, the car park of a public house, to the third shop along, which was the chemist. Well, I don't know whether you've ever tried walking out in pitch black with a torch with half of the light mast, and you're not allowed to move your torch so that the light comes off the pavement in front of you. And if you were seen lifting your torch off the pavement, you were seen by a policeman or an air raid warden, you could be arrested, because they would think that you were signalling any German aeroplanes who were flying up above you. And if you lit a cigarette out in the street, you had to mask it under your coat or with your hand so that. I mean, who would see a cigarette light hundreds of feet up in the sky? Ludicrous, but those were the regulations. So we start to go down to the chemist shop, and we got just past the shops on the Kingsbury Road to the fencing at the side of the pub garden, and I dropped the torch, and we spent about 15 minutes on our hands and knees, feeling with our hands, trying to find this torch. I eventually found it. We got down to the pub, and there was a man hanging round in the car park. And as we walked past, he followed us, and we didn't have a fence or anything to guide us, and we had to guess where the other side of the car park was without bumping into the walls or anything. Anyway, we got to the shops, tried the first door, no lights, locked up. Second door, no lights, locked up. Third door, no lights, locked up. But we heard somebody inside, so we banged on the door, and the chemist said, "I just locked up." So we said, "Oh, Mummy sent us to get a jar of Vick for our baby sister. She's very, very ill, and Mummy can't afford to send for the doctor. Mummy thinks she's got bronchitis. Can we have a jar of Vick, please? So we put the lights out, opened the door and let us in. Gave us the Vick. And we get outside and go to put the torch on, and the battery had gone. So we heard somebody sort of shuffling around by the other shops. And my sister said, "That man's there again, he's following us." So I said, "Well," I said, "instead of walking close to the shops, we'll go further out and try and walk on the edge of the pavement," which we did. And we got across the car park, and his footsteps eventually faded. We turned right into the Kingsbury Road, and we had to go up to a large roundabout, a junction of Holly Lane and Kingsbury Road. And there was a small part of Holly Lane on the other side of the roundabout. If you went down that part, you ended up on the Tyburn Road. Anyway, we crossed over before the roundabout, and we took the first turning left, and we ended up going down this short road. And we came to the corner and hadn't a clue where we were, pitch dark. And then I heard a tram coming along the road, and I said, "We're on the Tyburn Road, Frances, we've taken the wrong turning." So she said, "Oh," she said, "we'd better turn round and go back." So we walked along the, being guided by the fencing of the gardens, and we got to the corner and we turned left. And we got to walk up, I don't know, about from here to Marlborough Park, along the road here. And then we turned left, and we would know where we were on the estate. Anyway, we got halfway along and we heard some footsteps coming towards us. And by this time, I was crying with fear. And I heard these footsteps, and I started screaming. And I sank down on the ground, and I couldn't move with fear. And the footsteps stopped, and I heard a voice say, "Frances? Teresa? Is that you? Is that my girls?" "Daddy, Daddy, I'm so frightened." I got up, and he came towards us, and I jumped up at him, and he put his arms around me, and he said, "Shh, shh, you'll be all right. Where on earth have you been? Do you know what time it is?" "No, Daddy, I know we've been out a long time. We'd have to go down to the shop about 4:45, and it was now about 7:30. We've been watching around in the dark all this time. Mother thought we got lost." Anyway, that was the 1st of September. On the 3rd of September was the declaration of war and the bombs in Rookery Park. The following week, on the Saturday, on the 9th, Mum took Frances and I shopping up Erdington High Street, where just before the shops closed at 5:30. And then we were going on to Erdington Abbey Church to confession. And as we got to the end of the high street, the trams used to run along the high street until 1938, when they were transferred to a new road that had been built behind the high street, a sort of new road. So where the two roads joined, that was the tram terminus. As it was a sort of, the road was like that. That was Sutney Road, that was Erdington High Street, and the tram terminus was just up here. And here was Erdington Village Green, with the public library behind it. And as we went across the road, over the terminus onto Sutney Roadside, we saw a man in the shadows swaggering about on the opposite pavement. So Mum said to us, she said, "You stay here, girls. Stay on the pavement." She said, I'll go across and to see what's wrong with the man, he might be ill. So she went across to him, and he started wandering across the road. And Mum tried to restrain him, and he wouldn't give in. He struggled, and he got across to the tram lines. And we heard her talking to him, couldn't hear what she was saying. And he let her guide him back to the pavement. She stood with him for a little while, and she was talking to him. She came across to us, and she said, we said, oh, what's wrong with him, Mum? She said, oh, he's drunk. He reeks of whiskey. And Mother should know, because her father was a drunk. Anyway, as she was talking, I looked up, and I said, oh, Mum, I said, he's back on the tram lines. So she said, oh, no. So she said, you stay here. So she went back to the man, and she talked to him, and he'd got a, he was carrying a cycle lamp which was masked out like the torch was, and he started to walk down the tram lines. So Mum was saying to him, no, you mustn't go down there, there'll be a tram along in a minute and you'll get knocked over. No, come back, come on, I'll take you back to the pavement. And he said, no, leave me alone, I know what I want to do. And he pushed Mum, pushed her so hard he knocked her over. She lay on the ground for a little while in shock. And meanwhile, he carried on walking down the tram lines. And as Mum picked herself up, she went to go after him, and there was a loud bang. And we heard the tram driver put the brakes on, and the trams had metal wheels, and they ran on the metal lines, and there was metal on metal screech. It went right through you, and he eventually came to a stop, and he jumped down. And by that time, Mum was at the tram, and he said, "I didn't see him, Missus. I honestly didn't see him." Mum said, "No, I know you didn't." She said, "It's not your fault." So he said, did you see him before he came down the line? She said, yes. She said, he was drunk. She said, and I tried to get him to stay on the pavement, but he knew what he wanted to do. So he said, well, he said, can I ask you to stay with me until the beat Bobby comes along? He said, I was just about to pull up on the turnaround, the overhead wires. He said, he said, I would wait here about 15 minutes and the beat Bobby would join me, and we'd sit in the tram and have a cup of tea from the flask. We'd have our break together, we'd have a chin wag before getting back to work. So he said, he'll only be about 10-15 minutes. And Mum said, that's all right. She said, I'll wait. So when the beat Bobby came up, he said, he asked her if she'd witnessed it, and she said yes. So he said, how long had you been sort of with him? So Mum said, oh, quite a little time. She said, I tried to stop him, tried to get him off the tram lines a couple of times. He went the first time, but not the second. So he said, well, he said, I'll put in a report, he said, but there will be a coroner's inquest. He said, and you'll be required to attend. He said, and he said, it isn't a case of whether you want to or not. He said, because you are the sole witness. She said, well, with my daughters. He said, but even so, he said, if you don't come to the inquest, then they can't.